first on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This morning at the Washington County Historic Courthouse courtroom, G. Chad Mason, 4th Division Circuit Court Judge in the 4th Judicial District, announced a grant of $975,000 provided by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration in Washington, D.C.
This grant will allow us to further our efforts in providing resources and effective tools for these target defendants so that they can actually make changes in their lives, they can address the issues that led them into the criminal justice system to begin with.
Judge Mason oversees the Washington-Madison County Adult Drug Treatment and Diversion Court, which gives drug offenders the opportunity to avoid jail time by participating in intensive substance abuse treatment. Nearly 200 defendants participated last year, but the divisionary program has been chronically underfunded. The federal grant will enhance and expand the program into a holistic model. Judge Mason's team will partner with UAMS Department of Family Medicine to collect information to determine what treatment modalities are the most effective. Judge Mason also launched an innovative program he titled Work Court in the autumn of 2011. Qualified defendants are free during the day to don street clothes and work a regular job for minimum wage in order to pay off restitution to victims, court, and treatment costs, fees many offenders cannot afford. On hand for today's announcement were Congressman Steve Womack, along with Senators Mark Pryor and John Bozeman.
It's a lot of money, and yet on the other hand, it will save a lot of money because it will make it such that we'll solve problems now rather than let people lapse and come back into the system later, which will cost the taxpayers a great deal more money, besides just the human side of it and the loss of being productive citizens.
Last year, the program saw a collection of court fees from defendants increase from 36 to 95%, a total of $43,000. The alternative sentencing program is strictly for nonviolent, non-felony, first-time offenders.
Early voting for next month's presidential election is underway today in Arkansas. Melinda Allen, director of elections in Pulaski County, believes many people will take advantage of it.
We're expecting a really, really big turnout. And of course, over the years, early voting, it seems like it always increases. So I think it's just getting more popular as years go on.
Allen says Pulaski County will have 9 early voting locations, while Washington County has 3 and Benton County has 6. Registered voters can go to any one of those sites, but voting will only be held in regular polling locations on Election Day. You can learn more at the county's websites, and for other parts of the state, voters should contact their local county election offices.
At the Washington County Courthouse this morning at 8 o'clock, more than 2 dozen people were lined up for the first moments of early
voting. Really?
Yes. Speaking of Election Day, a new poll shows that support for the proposed half-cent highway tax is now at a dead heat. According to the most recent Talk Business Hendricks College poll, 44% of Arkansans polled said they were opposed to enacting the 10-year temporary tax, while 44.5% say they would support it, which would be used to pay for a statewide four-lane highway system. The tax appears to be gaining support. The same poll taken in late July showed that 42% of those responding were supportive of the highway tax, while then 49.5% of those polled were against the measure. The same Talk Business Hendricks College poll shows support seems to be eroding for the medical marijuana ballot initiative. According to the new poll, 54% of those polled were against enacting the measure, which would allow people diagnosed with serious debilitating medical conditions to purchase marijuana from nonprofit dispensaries. 38% of those polled say they are supporting the measure. But in late July, the same Talk Business Hendricks College poll found that 47% of likely voters were supporting the medical marijuana measure, while then only 46% said they would not vote for the issue.
The city of Fayetteville will break ground later this week for the new recycling drop-off facility on North Street. The groundbreaking will take place at 9:30 Wednesday morning next to Skull Creek Trail on North Street. The new facility is named for Marion Orton, who served in city government and several area organizations before her death in September of 2011.
Razorback volleyball team had a successful weekend. Friday night, the team won in 3 sets over Kentucky. Yesterday, the Hogs netted a 3-set victory over Mississippi State. With those victories, the team improves to 16-6 overall, 7-4 in SEC play. And the soccer team for the Razorbacks also had a successful weekend. The team defeated number 16 Missouri on Friday, marked the second time the Razorbacks have ever defeated a ranked team. And the luck didn't stop there. Hogs rallied to defeat Mississippi State yesterday. The pair of victories improves the team's record to 9-8-1 overall, 6-5-1 in the SEC.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political stories of the last week. Murphy Oil said Tuesday it will spin off its downstream subsidiary, Murphy Oil USA, into an independent and separately traded company, making the El Dorado-based firm a pure-play exploration and production company. Murphy Oil's plan will create two publicly traded companies, its oil and gas exploration and production group, commonly referred to as upstream operations, and its marketing and retail operations, commonly referred to as downstream. The spinoff of Murphy USA is expected to be finalized in 2013. Hawker Beechcraft announced it intends to emerge from Chapter 11 protection as a standalone company. Wichita, Kansas-based Hawker Beechcraft, which has major operations in Little Rock, also announced it's no longer pursuing its $1.79 billion merger with Superior Aviation Beijing Company. That's because the two parties could not reach an agreement on terms for a partnership. Now, after the Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the company intends to rename itself Beechcraft Corporation, and it's going to implement a business plan that focuses on turboprop, piston, special mission, and trainer attacked aircraft, which are the company's most profitable products. The company's Little Rock facility is known for its production work on high-performance business jets and its maintenance division. Hawker said it could sell some or all of those product lines or a closure of the entire jet business if no satisfactory bids are received. NextLife Asset Recovery Services announced it will open a new headquarters and processing facility in Rogers, Arkansas. Company plans to invest more than $10 million and hire 350 new jobs, 340 of which will be manufacturing, processing, 10 will be in management. NextLife's Rogers location will recycle post-consumer plastics into an environmentally sustainable resin that can be used to manufacture new consumer plastic items. Companies already secured agreements with several companies to supply. Home Bank Shares, the parent company of Centennial Bank, announced third quarter earnings of $16.1 million. That's up 16% compared to 1 year ago. Home Bank Shares said the quarter was the most profitable quarter in the bank's history. It also said its strong financial position would allow it to pursue future acquisitions. Stribling Equipment will acquire the heavy equipment dealership operations of Warrior of Arkansas, a company operating numerous locations servicing Arkansas and portions of Texas and Oklahoma. Terms of the private deal were not disclosed. The western territories of Stribling will be served by seven new locations in Little Rock, Springdale, Texarkana, Fort Smith, Camden, Monticello, and Arkadelphia. Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, an already declared candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor, raised more than $1 million for his 2014 bid during his first 3 months of fundraising. In his first campaign finance report for governor, McDaniel reported raising a little over $1 million and spent just a little over $138,000. The report showed that $923,000 was donated for the Democratic primary and a little more than $112,000 for a potential runoff. McDaniel is the only declared candidate for governor in 2014. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. A musical sculpture garden is being installed on a public pocket park along North Main Street in Eureka Springs, the only one like it in the United States. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us there.
This is what North Main Street Park sounds like. But by next May, residents and visitors will hear these sounds. Renaga Farbiage walks along a stone pathway with one of his musically tuned wind chimes. It's a prototype of a much larger chime installation he will install here, which will play a certain iconic melody.
This is John Lennon's All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance. So the sculpture will be ringing out a message of peace constantly. Part of the interpretation will explain that if you strike the notes in a particular pattern, you will play Give Peace a Chance. But whether you know that or not, it'll still be sounding a call for peace.
Wind chime artist Renaga Farbiage builds musically tuned wind chimes for a living. He markets them at Renaissance festivals and arts and crafts fairs across the country. Born in Germany in 1948 to Ignaz and Helen Farbiage, two Polish Holocaust survivors, Renaga learned fabrication from his father, an inventor and expert in electrical engineering. Renaga's Celestial Winds Harmonic Bazaar, his retail store and workshop, located on Highway 23 South of Eureka Springs, has become a popular tourist attraction because suspended from a large oak tree out front hangs the world's largest musically tuned wind chime. That's according to the Guinness Book of World Records. But Renaga's most noted sound installation to date was staged at the prestigious Walker Arts Center in Minneapolis several years ago. It's a fabrication commissioned for French artist Pierre Huyghe for the exhibition The Quick and the Dead in the center's sculpture garden.
In 2009, I was commissioned to do a sound piece for the Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis by a French artist. It was a deconstruction of a John Cage score called Dream. We took the score for Dream, which was originally commissioned by the Martha Graham Dance Company, and deconstructed the piece into 49 individual wind chimes that were tuned to every single note that John Cage wrote. These are hanging in a grove of trees next to the Spoonbridge and Cherry at the Walker Arts Center in the Sculpture Garden.
Spoonbridge and Cherry, an immense outdoor sculpture created by American artist Klaus Oldenburg. And for Eureka's North Main Street Park, Renaga is designing three individual sound sculptures.
One will be a large marimba-like structure. One will be a chime tree-like a serpentine chime tree piece that'll actually play a section of recognizable music. Will be 20 feet long, and it'll be serpentine that you'll be able to tap the pieces individually to get the musical sounds, or you'll be able to, I can see children, you know, just running under this thing, kind of joyfully dancing under the pieces and playing it that way.
And the serpentine chime tree will be made up of 10 groups of chimes, each tube a quarter of an inch in width and 8 to 18 inches in length, depending upon the tone.
The Ozarkophone will be wooden slats tuned in a pentatonic scale, and they'll have a sound similar to this.
The third will be made of huge metal tubes partially buried in the earth.
The Stonehenge-like metallophone and the wooden Ozarkophone, I call it, which will be made out of cedar planking, cedar and walnut planking, will both be tuned in a pentatonic scale, which is similar to the black keys on a piano. For anyone who's ever sat down at a piano and just pounded on the black keys, you can't hit a bad note. So if you want to impress your friends, if you just play the black keys on a piano, if you have any kind of rhythm or timing, you'll be able to play a tune. I also recently learned that most gospel tunes are written in pentatonic scales. So the metallophone will have a sound similar to this.
Patrons understand and play the musical sculpture interpretation will be installed as well. Other artists will also be pitching into this project.
I've been chosen as the project designer and chief sound designer for the Eureka Springs Sound Park, but we'll be collaborating with other Eureka Springs artists in the creation of the sculptural elements to make it a true collaborative project.
The planned sculpture garden is located in one of the most neglected sections of Eureka, dotted with abandoned limestone facades and a few rundown homes. But things are slowly improving. This wooded parcel of land, originally gifted to the city by William and Carolyn Bomberger in 1991, has served as a free parking area for residents who work downtown and as a trolley stop for visitors. In recent years, the city transformed two-thirds of the lot, creating gardens and building walkways, picnic tables, and benches. A public restroom is planned, along with a visitor's kiosk. A new sidewalk connects the park to the shopping district several blocks south. Leatherwood Creek flows to the north just across the street, and Old Depot Spring is located nearby. Members of the Eureka Springs Downtown Network are now responsible for the gardens, but Sandy Martin, chair of the Eureka Springs Arts Council, is responsible for coming up with the idea of transforming this site into a musical sound sculpture park.
We wanted to, at the Eureka Springs Arts Council, we wanted to beautify different locations throughout the city, particularly the points of entry in the city. And North Main was one that was just begging for something. This park was here. It's a beautiful park. It has free parking. It's a nice gateway and a nice showcase going in and out of the city. So we thought this would be a terrific area to do it. Plus, we want to revitalize all of the North Main area. We're getting so jam-packed downtown and so many activities at Basin Park that this also provides another venue for activities, events, concerts, and the musical sculpture park just fit in beautifully.
This summer, the local arts council learned it would receive a substantial grant to start up the project.
We were able to get a grant with the great help of Glenna Booth at the city. We collaborated with the city and the community development project of Western Carroll County. And we applied for a grant through the Arkansas Arts Council and received $6,400 to get us started on this grant. And they loved the idea. We took some sketches that Renaga had done. They said it was unique and fresh, and were real interested in following the project.
Because this district is zoned both commercial and residential, a community meeting was held to inform neighbors about the endeavor, who have all signed on. Outdoor sculpture parks are commonplace across Europe, and we have around 30 of them in North America. Musical sculpture parks, however, are rare. The city of Montreal in Quebec recently constructed Harmony Park. It features tuned drums, marimba, and chimes, all fixed and bolted into aggregate concrete walkways. It's a little sterile looking. Eureka's musical sculpture park, however, will be much more organic, blending in with the forested mountain setting. Renaga Farbiage will spend the winter building the three musical sculptures in anticipation of a spring unveiling. Eureka Springs Arts Council Chair Sandy Martin.
Renaga will start working, has started working on the instruments already, and we're going to unveil it during the 2013 May Festival of the Arts. So it'll probably be right around the beginning of the festival for the kickoff of it, and we're planning some events. We want a lot of kids down here to participate in sound and music and outdoor venue as well. So that's when we're going to kick it off.
And hopefully by next spring, the little unnamed park, blooming with jonquils, forsythia, and sound, will also be christened and named. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It's Monday, October 22nd, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Crazy busy around here.
Yes, with the fundraiser and everything.
Very cool. Well, we've got some things for you to go do this evening if you survive.
Okay.
There's an architecture lecture. If these don't sound exciting, you should go. They really are. Joel Sanders talking about groundwork between landscape and architecture at 5:30 in the Hembry Auditorium at the University of Arkansas. The fall choral concert with students from the Academy of the Arts at UAFS is tonight at 7 at Central Christian Church in Fort Smith, and that's free. And the experimental pop trio Brainstorm.
Huh.
Comes to Fayetteville this week in support of a new album called Heat Waves. I'm told by Kevin Kinder, the What's Up Music writer, that they combine West African guitar influences and soul. And they'll play with the band Swimming tonight.
Yes. And we just talked to them on Friday.
They'll be at Nightbird Books. Doors open at 9 o'clock. Music starts at 9:30, way past my bedtime. And admission for the all-ages show is $5.
Excellent. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Kyle?
KUAF is supported by Arcom Printing, located on the hillside just east of the Township and College intersection in Fayetteville. Arcom Printing provides printing, copying, and digital output services. ArcomPrinting.com or 444-7711. Support for KUAF also comes from Walton Art Center and the 10x10 Art Series, featuring L.A. Theater Works' production of Pride and Prejudice, Friday, October 26th. This is a radio theater performance of Jane Austen's classic novel, including live sound effects. Tickets and more information available at waltonartcenter.org or 443-5600. This is Ozarks at Large. History and the present can have parallels. This is quite apparent in the book Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America by Richard White. He is the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at Stanford University and the author of 8 books, including The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lakes Region, a book that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Last week, he was on the University of Arkansas campus to discuss the men and processes that made the railroads possible. And as part of the Hartman Hotz lecture series at the University of Arkansas, he delivered a lecture titled, What is the Purpose of the American Economy? A History Lesson. He came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio last week. He says, while many in the 21st century would say the purpose of the American economy is to buy things and keep people employed, that wasn't the prevailing thought more than 150 years ago.
That's the sort of common sense answer, but that's not necessarily the answer anybody would have given you in the 19th century. In the 19th century, the purpose of the American economy was to produce democratic citizens. A democracy to survive had to have citizens who were independent, who were secure, and who, in fact, had what they called at the time a competency. And an economy that didn't provide those things was not a successful economy.
In what ways could you make a successful economy then?
The way you make a successful economy was you had to make sure that everybody had the opportunity to earn enough money to support their family and put something aside for bad times in the future, because I presume there would be bad times, that everyone had to have an even chance, that the worst thing that could be in an economy is when they thought some people had special privileges, and that the result of this economy they thought would be a society which they thought they'd had at about the time of the Civil War of not very many very rich people and not very many very poor people. As a matter of fact, what they thought is that any economy that produced very rich people was also going to produce very poor people, and it was a sign of problems with the Republic.
Are you talking about the 19th century or the 21st century?
I'm talking about the 19th century sometimes sounds like the 21st century, and that's why very often deep down in these political campaigns you hear echoes of the 19th century, is that it's not that their programs are going to do anything about it, but if you listen to both the Obama campaign and you listen to the Romney campaign, they keep trying to make the other side enemies of security, enemies of opportunity, and advocates of special privilege. And in that, they're really hitting at very old and deep American values, which go back well over 100 years.
You mentioned that this was the thought before the Civil War. The Civil War takes its toll on the economy.
It's about the time of the Civil War. Remember, what the Civil War was supposed to do was it was eliminating slavery. It was going to, in fact, eliminate the great anomaly in the American system. It was going to eliminate what they saw, Northerners saw, as a privileged class of slave owners. And it was going to eliminate those who, in fact, could not benefit from their own labor, which is slaves. So they thought at the time that what the Civil War had accomplished is finally brought about what they saw as this sort of golden ideal of American democracy. And the great symbol of this, of course, is Lincoln and Lincoln's Springfield. This was a time where there were very few rich people in American society, and now they thought with the elimination of slavery, there would be no poverty that could be blamed on anybody but the person who was laboring themselves. So that Lincoln gives these speeches where he'll say, in this free labor economy, you will be rewarded for your efforts, and that nobody, except unless they have incredibly bad luck or are naturally dependent, is going to end end up poor. They really thought they'd achieve that level. They, of course, are tremendously wrong. The rest of the 19th century will prove them wrong, and this politics comes out of trying to understand what went wrong, what's going wrong now that we thought we'd achieve success.
You, in fact, have some people build up the largest amounts of personal wealth in the history of this country.
Yeah, and those are the people who become – I mean, it's odd now that those people are – admired and seen as entrepreneurs, they were hated at the time. I mean, you go back through the political cartoons at the time, and they are seen as creatures of special privilege. They're seen as people who are being rewarded by legislatures, by being granted charters, corporations, which give them the ability to do things ordinary people can't do. And worse than that, they cut the opportunities of ordinary people. So that over and over and over again, the problem with the rich is not just that they're rich, but by giving them the special privileges, it allows them to limit the opportunities for other people. And what you have in the late 19th century is incredible turmoil. Because what they're arguing about is not whether the United States should be capitalist, but what capitalism means in the late 19th century. There's relatively few socialists in late 19th century America, but there are bitter arguments over what a democratic capitalism should be.
These arguments played out in newsprint?
They play out in newsprint. I mean, all you have to do is go through 19th century journals from, you know, Punch, Wasp on the West Coast, and you'll find some of the classic American political cartoons. And they're symbols we still use now. The large, top-hatted, fat, cigar-smoking tycoon is a creature of the late 19th century. And the octopus is a symbol of monopoly, which is not just one railroad. It's used over and over again. These kinds of things become these classic political representations. And what they're all connected with is this idea that it's special privilege that is creating these things and that it hurts everybody and it has to be eliminated.
You mentioned that you had a certain naivete before you started researching this. I imagine researching, investigating history is a great way to get rid of naivete.
It is, but it takes time. I mean,
right.
Railroaded took me about 12 years. And essentially what I do and what many historians do is I read dead people's mail. And what I tend to do is just start at the beginning of a long set of correspondence and read it through. I was tremendously lucky with the people I was writing about because they were smart. They were funny, they were utterly cynical, and they were inventing things as they went along. So they have to explain it to each other. And it turned out that Leland Stanford, who was not the sharpest tool in the shed, had to have an awful lot explained to him. So my great advantage was I could sit in for Leland Stanford. It all had to be explained to me. So Collis B. Huntington, Mark Hopkins, all of these others will spend their time explaining to Stanford what he's done wrong and what they're trying to do, what the problem is, which means as a historian, they're also explaining to me.
You say he's not the sharpest tool. That's a charitable thing compared to some of the other accounts you give. It's at this point that I want to point out that you are on the faculty of
Stanford University. Yes. Yes. Which doesn't bother Stanford a great deal at all. First of all, any member of the faculty of Stanford University realizes they don't matter that much to the university to begin with. And the second thing is that the university has all Stanford's money. There's nobody left to offend here.
You made the analogy earlier about railroads then to the tech world we live in now. In the opening pages of Railroaded, let's see if I can find it here. You're right. This was train travel before the Civil War, at once technologically impressive and nearly incoherent. It was exhausting, aggravating, uncomfortable, yet withal far better than any existing alternative Americans were prepared to love trains, hate trains, and be unable to live without them. That sounds like the internet to a T.
It sounds like the internet. It also sounds like I flew in here on an airplane. It sounds like the airline industry. And it's true. These are things which, when they work, allow you to do things which you couldn't even conceived of 10 years ago. You get so used to having them there. When they don't work, it's incredibly frustrating because the other thing they do is they also gradually eliminate all the other alternatives to them. And it's the complaints about Google, for example, right now, is that Google, you know, in my opinion, worked a lot better 3 or 4 years ago. But once Google really begins to dominate a market, now you go through a lot of stuff before you ever get what used to come up right away. So one of the things, this is why the word monopoly occurs over and over again in the 19th century. They begin to realize this dependence, and what they mean by monopoly is the internet's a good example. They don't mean something that controls all of a market. They mean an industry that once it's in place, you cannot live without. And that's what we have. That's what the railroads were. That's what the Internet is. So the Internet is a very, very good example of that.
Does it make you as a historian bristle a little bit, though, when I make this sort of casual comparison? I mean, and we do this all the time. Like, this is just like that.
Yeah. It does, but I'm, you know, I'm hard to offend. And the other thing is I'm always glad to complicate virtually anything you want to complicate. I think what we always have to do with the initial easy comparison is to step back and see the ways that they're different. And there are real differences between the Internet and railroads. You know, Richard John, who's a wonderful historian, has people started describing the telegraph as the 19th century Internet, and it drove him crazy. He was right. It's nothing at all like the Internet. But I think the kind of analogy you gave, which is a broad analogy of simply people's dependence on a new technology and how they use it, that's perfectly fine. If you begin to say the Internet works exactly like a railroad, well, I'd say yes and no, because one of the ways that they are like a railroad, and I'll make this as simple as I can. And the Internet, as you all know, when you send something over the Internet, it breaks it up into little pieces and it goes in all kinds of directions and comes back together in the end. Well, that's exactly the way they used to send cargo over a railroad. Mm-hmm. It's not this sort of straight shot through in a single line. So actually, in the very technique of the Internet, it does mirror 19th century railroads, which allows us in computer programs to sometimes mimic how traffic moves on a railroad.
Is it true that workers' comp eventually comes from the railroad work?
It does. It comes in the early 20th century after the time I'm talking about, and it first starts out with precisely for railroad workers, because what we forget about is how dangerous this work was. I mean, even conservative senators, Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts gives a speech where he points out and then writes an article pointing out that as many people as were killed and wounded in the Battle of Shiloh, the Civil War battle, are killed and wounded on the railroads every single year, and that's not counting passengers, that's railroad workers. When I read through this stuff, it's this small-scale carnage. I mean, it's not big accidents, but every day people losing arms, people losing legs, people being killed. And this mounts up over these railroads, because these are the biggest employers in America, over the course of the year. So it becomes a national scandal how dangerous it is to actually run a train.
This is what we call a softball question, but here it comes. There obviously is a huge value in a country that knows and continues to know its history. When you think of OSHA might be able to go back to the Triangle Factory fire, or workers' comp coming out of this dangerous work. But we often – this gets – it doesn't take long for something to get shoved into the dustbins of history.
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's why it's always useful to be doing history during a political campaign, when you realize nobody even remembers what somebody said 2 months ago. How are they going to remember 2 years ago, 20 years ago, 200 years ago? But, you know, the fact is all of those events, as distant as they seem, shaped and constructed the world that we live in today. And the other thing it does is that we often see our own issues as unique when there's nothing unique about them. Then, in fact, we have faced situations like this before, and we might be able to learn something about how we reacted at the time. But the United States loves to celebrate the past, but it very rarely interrogates the past. But, you know, I'm a historian, and I live in a family where I'm the only historian, and people use the past in a lot of different ways. And one of the things I've realized is historians do incredibly cruel work. What we do is we take a series of things people assume about the past, people assume about themselves, and we destabilize them. We tear them apart. We shred them. And there's a good reason that people dislike historians. We are very uncomfortable people to have around.
I like that. When you're working for years on a project like railroaded, how do you keep from getting lost?
Well, in some ways, I want to get lost. I can't really begin to get a sense of what was going on in the past until the past begins to confuse me, until I begin to realize I'm in a world where I don't know exactly what's happening, then I'm going to have to figure it out. I mean, as the great cliche goes, the past really is a foreign country. I don't know the customs, and in many ways, I don't know the language. And for me, in a historical project, the best moment comes when I begin to, in fact, get it. I begin to realize, and this scares my wife, but she's been through it before, is the dead people who I'm living amongst are more alive to me than most of the people I see every single day. I know them. I know how they talk. I know how they think. And there's a moment, especially when I have a long run of correspondence, I can see a problem emerging. And I begin to see, I think I know what he's going to do or what she's going to do. And when they actually do it, at that moment, it's sort of nirvana. You realize, okay, I'm now totally among them. I've begun to understand that world, and I can begin to put it together. And, you know, for an academic, all this sounds pretty mystical, but I think for most historians who've spent a long time in the archives, there is this sense that you're piecing together a credible world that you can really defend. And to do that, I first have to get lost.
If people hearing this conversation say, you know what, I do want to know more about history, but sometimes you can walk into a bookstore, be it a physical one or a virtual one like Amazon.com, and you're just inundated. What's the best way to get to find out reliable, well-researched history?
Well, I think, you know, one of the ways to do it is there's a variety of ways. And one of them is to go through people that you already know who, in fact, you think you know history. I mean, you have a great advantage here in this area is that there's a great historian teaching at the University of Arkansas, Elliot West. So one of the first things I would do is I would start reading Elliot West. I would also then start reading the kinds of things that he talks about. Another way is to look at a certain kind of set of prizes. Ones that particularly if you're just getting into it reward not only good history writing, but good history, but good history writing. You know, in some ways, the Pulitzer Prize does it. In some ways, it doesn't. In other ways, the Parkman Prize does it. There's a variety of prizes which go to trying to look at books that go to being both good history and good writing. I would take a look at those, too. The other thing you can do is once you begin to find a set of writers you trust, see who those writers like and begin to read around that. Not all history writing is good. Not all historians agree with each other, but that's precisely the point, is that history is, in the end, an argument, just like politics is an argument, just like everything in our lives is an argument. And in this, I agree very much with the 19th century. The duty of a citizen is to be able to decide who is right, who is wrong, or more right and more wrong, and to evaluate an argument. And one thing you have to do with that is remember what happened before. And that's the critical thing.
Richard White, thank you so much for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
Richard White is the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at Stanford University and the author of 8 books, including The Middle Ground, Indians, Empires, and Republics in the Great Lakes Region, a book that was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book is titled Railroaded, The Transcontinentals and the Making of Modern America. He delivered a talk last week on the University of Arkansas campus as part of the Hartman Hotz Lecture Series, which is sponsored by the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences and the School of Law. This is Ozarks at Large.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, White Oak.
Where is White Oak, Arkansas?
It is in Johnson County. It's northeast of Ozark.
Not to be confused with Black Oak.
No, not to be confused with Black Oak.
Let's see. This is the fall fundraiser on KUAF.
Yes.
And I would encourage you, if you're listening to this online, that it's going to be very easy to pledge your support to KUAF online.
Yes, you can simply go to supportkuaf.com.
Any questions you have can be answered there. Mm-hmm. You can have us thank you on the air, but you don't have to.
No, you don't have to. We'd love to thank you, but you don't have to.
Right. And the method and the amount, that's all left up to you.
Absolutely. You can pay by credit card or debit card or check or we do... Bank draft. Thank you. I'm losing my words today. Bank draft.
Right.
And we also have payroll deduction for University of Arkansas employees.
Yes.
And so all sorts of options.
And then if you prefer to call,
yes.
if you'd rather call 1-800-522-5823, you can do that between 6 a.m. and 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
tomorrow.
And we'll have some volunteers here to take your call.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks for listening.